I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The people have spoken. Donald Trump has been elected the 45th president of the United States. It was a late night for the candidates, for the country, really. Hillary Clinton did not speak to her supporters at the Javits Center in New York, but did call Trump early this morning to concede. She's going to speak later this morning, and we will carry that live. Here's what Donald Trump told his supporters after his win.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
Trump's support came largely from disaffected white working class voters who rejected the status quo and political correctness. His victory defied the pollsters, the pundits, the political establishment, the mainstream media, the fact checkers, and is making global markets very nervous. Today on Radio Times, how did Trump do it? What does his campaign say about our politics and what happens next? Joining us are Byron Tao, who covers Washington for The Wall Street Journal. Byron, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Sam Wong. He's a data analyst, neuroscience professor at Princeton University, director of the Wong Lab. He's also co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, which did predict a big Hillary Clinton win. And Sam Wong, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. And also with us is Lara Brown, and she's associate professor, interim director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. And Lara, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me on.
Lara, let me begin with you. So what did Trump know that many other people did not know about voters this time?
I think Trump knew that many Americans had felt betrayed by the two political parties for years. There have been concerns about the economy, about our involvement in the wars in Iraq and all over the world. And I think many people in Washington looked away or said, oh, those are not issues that are our priorities for us. And I think Trump understood that he could make an argument that what was needed was a refocusing on the issues that mattered to people who had felt ignored for over a decade. And he was able to galvanize their support and turn them out and win the presidency.
Byron, what are the voters saying?
Well, it depends who you voted for. Trump supporters are, of course, ecstatic. Their man has been elected in a stunning upset, one of the greatest upsets in American history. As you noted, he defied all the pundits. He defied all the predictions. He defied the forecasts, and he defied the polls. On the other hand, a lot of supporters of Secretary Hillary Clinton are quite disappointed. And some of the photos from her supposed to be victory party last night, which never happened for obvious reasons, are quite touching. You saw folks crying. You saw a lot of young female supporters very upset that one of the big glass ceilings in American life won't be shattered. And so we, again, remain a divided country on the end of a very close, hard-fought election campaign, and depends who you are and how you see politics.
Sam, you're not the only person who was doing polling or certainly looking at polls and trying to predict who was going to win yesterday that, frankly, got it wrong. What do you think you missed?
Well, let's see. Let's back up a step here. So certainly there's a big miss that the polling industry made, and I followed them right into it, and that is entirely my judgment error that compounded their polling error. But just to return to an earlier point that we just heard, I think we should be careful not to overread too much into this, because fundamentally this is a polarization election. And what I mean by that is that it's the party lines were drawn up, and the great majority of Clinton and Trump supporters were Republican and Democratic and Republican partisans. And so fundamentally, Trump voters are, in fact, Romney voters. Now, it is true that there is something extra that he got that put him over the top, and we can ask about those extra voters. But I think that we should start by being careful and just pointing out that, in fact, polarization plays such a major role in politics. Now, as far as polling goes,
yes,
across the board, there's a polling error. I was looking at the numbers last night, and it looks like in opinion polls, if you take all the polls together, which usually do a pretty good job, it was a pretty large polling error, on average about 4 percentage points in state polls, national polls, and in Senate polls. And so in all cases, it appears that polls understated Trump's support and also Republican candidate support by about 4 percentage points. And I think that's a big question. 4% doesn't sound like a lot, maybe, but it is enough in a narrow election like today's, in which actually Hillary Clinton probably won the popular vote. It's by 1 percentage point. It's in such a narrow election, that kind of polling error, just as in Brexit, can make a pretty big difference.
But doesn't it call into question polling? I'm looking at what you posted actually yesterday morning at 6:06 a.m. This is electoral votes: Clinton 307, Trump 231. Mm-hmm. You were not the only one. I mean, a lot of pollsters were doing, or people relying on polls were doing this and predicting. So I guess I'm asking you the same question again, which is, what did you miss?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we don't know yet. A candidate that is very much on my mind right now is a late break of undecided voters. One indicator that seems to have swung pretty hard at the last minute was the generic congressional preference, which takes away Trump or any other name. It's just, who do you support for Congress? And that number swung by about 3 points at the very last minute in the last week of the campaign. And so I would say that one possibility is that that there is a swath of undecided voters who perhaps were Republican-leaning but couldn't quite bring themselves to support someone as unprecedented as Trump. And for that group, there is a battle between party loyalty and what to do about a candidate like Trump. And that is a group where party loyalty seems to have won. And so that is one way to think about it. But I think there's going to be a lot of postmortems to figure out exactly what was missing in the last minute opinion polls.
Laura, Hillary Clinton admitted during the campaign that she was not a natural campaigner. Was she a bad candidate?
Well, she certainly has her challenges in terms of connecting with people and providing that window into who she is as an authentic person. For many, many years now, people have knocked her as being sort of remote and entitled and not able to really touch people and give them that sense of who she is. And I think all of the controversies that ensued over the course of this campaign only reinforced that image. And certainly that was a problem. But I just want to get back to something that Sam said, because I agree completely that this was a partisan election. But I think what's also important and is something that we don't really sort of acknowledge is that political science always suggested that Hillary Clinton would be the underdog, that the Republicans would be in a favored position, because we all acknowledge that there is this factor called a time for change, and that typically parties in our modern era do not win 3 terms into the White House. So she was always in a, I would say, difficult position to carry on a sort of third term of Barack Obama's. But what we actually see here was that this was something of a repudiation of Barack Obama's time in office.
And he certainly put his legacy on the line for her, certainly in the last month or so of the election. Byron, let me turn to you. And I think what's confounding, frankly, is that you've got a candidate in Donald Trump who did not release his tax returns. It's unusual for modern politics. Apparently hasn't paid taxes or federal taxes in many years now. Multiple bankruptcies, incendiary, controversial, and maybe even criminal comments that were said during the campaign. He praised Putin. He encouraged Russians to hack our electoral system. And yet all of this, and there's much more, was not a disqualifier. How do you understand that?
That's right. I think it speaks to, you know, what other two panelists are speaking of, and that is how deeply polarized this country really is, that there is no amount of controversy, there is no amount of alleged wrongdoing that can shake some of the partisan biases that a lot of voters have, and that's on both sides of the aisle. Democrats nominated someone who was under a well-reported criminal investigation into the possible mishandling of classified information. Now, she was ultimately cleared, and everyone is innocent until proven guilty, but the court of public opinion is very different from a court of law. And so for both of these candidates, the fact is that they had a large population of voters that were going to cast votes for them no matter what. And that's sort of where we are as a country, that folks see things through partisan lenses, that there's a certain level of support baked in for both candidates from the beginning. And we're fighting over a very narrow slice of voters when it comes down to it in elections.
What's so interesting is Donald Trump has his court issues related to Trump University. And again, that did not seem like a disqualifier this go-round.
Right. And I do think there is a criticism that's emerging and has emerged about the media coverage of Donald Trump. A lot of people say he got a lot of free airtime. A lot of people say that the Hillary Clinton email scandal tended to dominate when it came to her. But let's not forget that there was an awful lot of very critical, very harsh coverage of Donald Trump. Everything from the lewd videotape that surfaced on the Washington Post website to about a dozen women alleging sexual misconduct to all the other things that you just identified. Trump University, his business record, his failure to be transparent with his taxes, and none of that did seem to matter. And again, it shows just how deeply polarized this electorate is, that so little negative coverage of either candidate can really move the needle. And ultimately, Donald Trump prevailed.
Well, let me read some comments that we're getting. A comment from Joseph: I stayed up until 1:30. I'm sad but not surprised at the outcome. Got to move on and hope for the best. A tweet: if you thought mass incarceration was bad before, imagine it under businessman Trump. A comment from Amanda: what the heck is going on in the last 24 hours? An email from Christian: I'm a non-U.S. citizen, a legal alien, Christian's words, 26, male, gay, and married, after having followed the coverage of this election very closely for the past year and a half. Yesterday's events have left me in shock and disbelief. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with our guests. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We have a president-elect, Donald Trump, to be the 45th president of the United States. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with Laura Brown, Sam Wong, and Byron Tao. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking about last night's election results. Laura Brown, Associate Professor, Interim Director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Sam Wong is a data analyst, a neuroscience professor at Princeton University, co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. And Byron Tao covers Washington for the Wall Street Journal. And again, you can join us by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Laura, is President Trump going to be able to deliver on many of the things that he talked about on the campaign trail, including building a wall, including rewriting some of these trade deals, including deporting millions of undocumented people in this country, preventing Muslims from entering the country?
Well, that's a great question. I think all of us here in Washington have this kind of one question on our mind. How much is Donald Trump going to be involved in the policy process versus how much is he going to delegate to his Vice President Mike Pence to work with Speaker Paul Ryan and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to actually get things done. In other words, is he going to try to wrangle some policy specifics, or is he going to step back and let the Republicans who do understand policy, who do understand the process, move things as far and as fast as they can and essentially take credit for them when they come out, even if they aren't consistent with any policy he has put forward?
Sam, what has been the turnout? I mean, certainly in Pennsylvania, the turnout was pretty dramatic. Was that true across the country from what you know?
Voting levels seem to be quite high, although I will say that the error in polling is across the board. So I think it's currently an open question whether the turnout made a difference. Normally, turnout, you would think, would favor the Democratic candidate. That has usually been the case. But obviously, this is probably not the case this time. So it'll be a question for the exit polls to figure that out.
And in terms of what they need to figure out is it the last couple of weeks? Is it pointing to some people have said James Comey in the server, that was one of the deciding factors? Is that the way it works, you think?
So the question is, who are these extra voters? So one way to ask this question is there's 4% more voters who voted for Republican candidates for president, for Senate, as you know, in Pennsylvania, and also in for House candidates. Where did these 4% extra voters come from? Because it's not just Trump. It's up and down the ticket. So one possibility, since there's so much partisan loyalty in voting that people tend to vote straight ticket, one possibility is that there are undecided voters who are soft on Trump because, as we know, he's polarizing not only between Republicans and Democrats, but he's even polarizing within the Republican Party. And so you can imagine a battle between voters who are loyal to the Republican Party and, you know, perhaps not all that strong on Trump. And he had a lot of weakness in red states, in very Republican states all along. And so, you know, one possibility is that polarization, which is such an important concept to understand, the emotionality of politics, did something happen there to make them all come home where, you know, if you're a lifelong Republican or if you're a loyal Republican, you can't quite bring yourself to vote for Trump, perhaps. But what you really don't want is you don't want Hillary Clinton. And so that polarization, I don't know, I think one possible explanation is that for some small but all-important swath of voters, that party loyalty won.
And Kellyanne Conway talked about the hidden Trump vote. Sam, do you think there was a hidden Trump vote?
I think that we need to find that out. I'm somewhat skeptical of that explanation. It's certainly possible, but there was not a large differential between, say, automated polls and live interviewer polls. If there were a four-point difference between those two kinds of polls, you'd think that it would have come out, and there was no such report of a four-point gap beforehand. So I think that the shy Trump voter, I guess if you think of the shy Trump voter as an undecided voter, then perhaps that would be it. So, so my answer to that is yes, but.
You know, Byron, I mentioned President Obama really going hard for Hillary Clinton, and essentially the message being that she will carry on what we started. I mean, that was sort of his message, certainly to minority voters, that if you like what I've done, you want to vote in Hillary Clinton. Is this a repudiation of the president?
Well, it's getting played as a repudiation of the president, and there is certainly an element to that, that voters did appear to be somewhat angry about the direction of the country in general and sometimes in some specific policy areas like the Affordable Health Care Act that the president championed. But here's some fascinating statistics that I found in the exit polls. It does appear, looking at the exit polls, and there's not a perfect question on this topic, but that there were some Obama voters, that there's some percentage of people who cast votes for Barack Obama in either 2008 or 2012 that then crossed over and voted for Donald Trump. For example, of the people who strongly approve of the president, 16 or somewhat approve of the president, 69% voted for Secretary Clinton, while 21% crossed over and voted for Donald Trump. In the who should whether the next president should continue President Obama's policies or be more conservative, 5% of the voters who said that the next president should continue Obama's policies voted for Donald Trump. So from the exit polls, we can sort of see hints that there was a percentage of the electorate that voted for President Obama and then turned around and voted for President Trump, despite the fact that President Obama hit the campaign trail very hard trying to encourage people to go vote for Hillary Clinton.
You know, Laura, I hear a lot of people saying we've never been here before. This has never happened before. And in certain ways, we've never had anyone get elected president of the United States. It's never held elective office or never been like Eisenhower, you know, in the military. Have we ever been here before?
Well, I appreciate you sort of raising this because I do think it's important. We've had sort of analogs in our history to these moments. So, for instance, my favorite election that I keep talking about and referring to is actually 1884. We had Grover Cleveland, who had been uncovered that he had had an illegitimate child. It was quite a sort of scandal at the moment. He had institutionalized the woman who had actually been the mother of his child. And that was versus James G. Blaine, who was an incredibly corrupt politician who had dealt in essentially railroad contracts. And so every time Congress was increasing the amount of money for the railroads, James G. Blaine was becoming wealthier. And this election was incredibly close. It was very fierce. It was very ugly. But it is true that Grover Cleveland was very much an amateur. He had served 1 year as mayor of Buffalo, 1 year as governor of New York, and then was essentially elected into the presidency. And it really happened because there was about 1,000 more votes that voted for Grover Cleveland in New York, and that tipped the Electoral College to him. So that kind of an election is a lot of what we've had, a very personal one that was very ethics and character driven, and one where the two parties were essentially at parity. And what moved the needle was allegedly, or at least historians have always said it did, was essentially a preacher in Manhattan referring to the Republicans as saying, "We are not the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion." And that insult was supposedly enough to turn Irish Catholics off of James G. Blaine and have them vote for Grover Cleveland.
And one wonders who is James G. Blaine, as you describe some of our history there, Laura Brown. I wonder to you, Sam, how much of what Donald Trump said about Hillary, crooked Hillary, the chance of locking her up, the idea that she was corrupt, that resonated with his voters.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. This again comes back. My magical explanation for my slogan for everything is polarization. We just heard about the 1884 election as being about personal factors as opposed to about issues and policies. The interesting thing about the email story is that it came to engulf the news, and it's sort of interesting because, you know, at some level it's an IT, at its heart it seems to be an information technology management issue, and if you look at the substance of it, there was never anything really big that came out of it. And yet news organizations really ran with it. It captured the imaginations, or maybe it was something that journalists could understand and that people could understand. And so there is some question about exactly what was going on there, because I think there's no shortage of things to say about Trump, and many of those did get said. And so how is it that that particular story came to dominate? And the feeling that that Hillary Clinton is corrupt, this is it doesn't seem to be well supported by that particular piece of evidence, and yet it is undeniably true that many Republican voters feel that way. 80% of voters on the Republican side, I believe, feel that she should be in prison. And so it's just totally it appears to be a tribute to how polarized voters have become. And I'm just going to throw in for people who are perhaps renewed in their interest of 1884, that I believe the slogan for Grover Cleveland, the taunt was, "Ma, ma, where's my pa?"
That's
and
right.
And the counter taunt was, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha."
Byron, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump essentially promised his supporters he was going to prosecute Hillary Clinton. Do you think he'll renege on that promise?
Well, that's a great question. You know, at first, it was something that seemed spontaneous at rallies. His crowds would start chanting, "Lock her up." We saw that famously at the Republican National Convention. But eventually, he came to adopt that line as his own and say that she belongs in jail, that she's crooked, she's corrupt. Yesterday, we heard a much more magnanimous tone from him. We heard him praise her contribution to public life. And, you know, ultimately, I do think the fact that a nonpartisan FBI director cleared her, that she has lost the election, that the stakes are much lower and that it would be very difficult to continue and also would be seen as distasteful in a lot of ways and political to continue the investigation of her. But anything is possible.
Let me read some comments and we'll get some callers and an email from AB. I think a lot of the credit for the outcome of this election is due to the right-wing media rush and company stirred up mighty dissent among the unhigher educated class. An email from a New Jersey listener. The American voter has spoken and proved the pundits wrong. Shame on all the networks, the journalists and radio programs who touted Clinton with their anti-Trump stories. Crow for dinner. Let me see what Eric from Southampton has to say. Eric, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I only have one question.
Sure.
I was reading the Inquirer this morning, and I see hardly any mention of the popular vote. It's page after page after the electoral results. I witnessed in the last 20 years, two elections where the popular vote, the guy won, but he was not the one that was elected eventually. And I need to know, and the question and answer to the last, how do I have any faith in the system? If my popular vote eventually doesn't really mean anything in the end. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Eric, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Obviously referring to Al Gore there. Laura, why do we have the Electoral College?
Well, it's a long constitutional story, but really what the framers did in creating it was try to replicate the way representation happens in the Congress, in the sense that there is weight for the population, but there is also weight in your vote for the state that in which you reside. So your votes are counted by state. The way to think about it is that it's like the World Series and not like the Super Bowl. A party has to win many games, if you will, many of the states, not just the overall aggregate total. And while I can sympathize with the individual's sort of personal frustration and feeling, I think what you see here and what you see in the vast majority of instances with the Electoral College is that it typically magnifies the winning vote margin of the candidate at the popular level. And there are the only times where it has misses is when the country is essentially at 50-50. And there are really no good systems election-wise that deal with sort of a 50-50 result.
Thank you for giving that very concise answer. Let me see what Howard. Eric, thanks for the call. Here's Howard joining us from Pennsylvania. Howard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thanks
good morning.
For my call.
Absolutely.
I just kind of like to point out, I think it's really a polling issue that seems to be getting missed here. I was a Barack Obama supporter for 08 and 12. I voted for Trump. I'm a college-educated male. And it was really a vote for me was really, I just can't stand anything in the Clintons. And I think it can come down to that at the end of the day.
Was it both Clintons? And, Howard, was it both Clintons for you, or was it something about Hillary herself?
To me, they're one of the same. And then I look at the polling numbers, and I was even at my polls, and I noticed there was a lot of people that have never voted before. Polls weren't talking to these people. And a lot of rural individuals showed up at the polls. And their voice has never been heard. It's never been polled. I think they've been getting missed. I don't know if they can address the accuracy of polling in rural areas, really.
It's a great question, Howard. You called the right place. Let me see what Sam Wong has to say. Sam, can you answer Howard's question?
About the failure of the polling industry?
Well, what we're hearing is that certainly Pennsylvania is a perfect example of that, which there was a big turnout here in the Philadelphia area, but also a big turnout across the state, enough to take Donald Trump across the finish line.
I think the overall pattern appears to be one of high turnout on both sides. And so there were a lot of anecdotal reports last night of fairly you know, jubilant Democrats, say, coming from suburban counties and places like Northern Virginia and so on, saying, wow, turnout is higher than 4 years ago. This place is really crowded. The Hispanic communities along the border in Texas and Arizona saying high turnout. And I think that what we're looking at here is high turnout on both sides. And so it is certainly the case that that voters were energized. And what we see here is, in fact, there was a lot of energization on the Trump side. And I think that we are, as we sort through the rubble of both pre- and post-election polling, we're going to learn a lot about exactly who did turn out and who didn't turn out.
Byron, this is something I've been thinking about in the last 12 hours or so, is that our first black president will be succeeded by the most outspoken birther, who denied that Barack Obama was a real American, that he really was a citizen of this country. Do we need to make something of that, or is that ancient history?
I think not only will the first black president be replaced by a birther, but Trump is sort of the first birther. I mean, he really did ride his political hitch his political career to this outlandish and ultimately completely ridiculous theory that President Obama was not born in the United States, and it took him until fairly recently, a few weeks ago, to even repudiate that stance. And
he blamed it on Hillary Clinton.
He did, and I will also say, as someone who wrote the story that is often cited for that talking point, that is not true, that Hillary Clinton never did, or nor did her campaign circulate the rumor that President Obama was not born in the United States. I do think this is being overlooked in the stunning upset that he pulled off, and it is something that we will and historians will have to grapple with when talking about the president's legacy and President-elect Trump's legacy.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about what the country, I think the world, is talking about today, the fact that Donald Trump elected the 45th president of the United States. That's Byron Tao, who covers Washington for The Wall Street Journal. Sam Wong is a data analyst, a neuroscientist at Princeton University, co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. And Laura Brown, associate professor, interim director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, wrote a book called Jockeying for the American Presidency. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. And also call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me read some tweets and some comments. A tweet from Nan: I'm just numb. I thought Bush's second term was upsetting. A tweet from ATP: Democrats put all their hope in one basket, a month of ads with nothing but bad boy quotes by Donald Trump, while half of his were about issues and change. An email from Paul: is it possible that Trump's ego is involved with how history judges him and his presidency? An email from Peter: can the last-minute swing of undecided voters to Trump be blamed on the reemergence of the email server issue? Did Comey and the FBI agents I'm going to just move on there. The question whether there were questions about her server that really derailed her candidacy. Let me get Steve from outside Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty.
Hey there.
I'm a 44-year-old college graduate, professional, voted for Obama the past two times. Looking back on it, I wish I hadn't, but basically, I guess the point I wanted to make was I really think this was this exposed the media for their really harsh bias. It was really, if anyone had any doubt in the past that there was bias in the media, it was cleared up with this whole election cycle, and I found it very disgusting. Most of the media was anti-Trump, and the pile-on was just ridiculous. And I think this is going to end up hurting most of the left-wing media, including NPR, who I used to donate to. And I, up until the past year, thought of as more of a neutral source. And it's all gone now. So I'll take any comments off the air.
Steve, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think there will be a lot of of a discussion, maybe even some soul searching about the kind of coverage of this campaign. And I think you can look at it. I'll put that to you, Byron, as someone who covers Washington for The Wall Street Journal. A year ago, people were saying, you know, that especially cable talk TV was all over Donald Trump, giving him $2 billion worth of friendly advertising. And now the feeling is that the media changed on this. Can you sort this out at all, or is it too soon?
Sure. I mean, I do think some of it's too soon, but I do think the caller does raise some interesting points. I mean, sure. The relationship between the media and President-elect Trump is poisonous. That he has feuded with multiple national media outlets. He has incited chants of CNN sucks at his rallies. He has banned the Washington Post, Politico, and others, BuzzFeed, from his rallies. And so, you know, there is an underlying deep level of distrust and tension between the people that cover Donald Trump and the Trump campaign and Donald Trump himself. On the other hand, you know, in defense of myself and my colleagues, Donald Trump got negative headlines because he did unprecedented things. And, you know, he feuded with his party leaders. He often aired grievances at the national level with ordinary citizens. He had direct access to a Twitter account where he made news routinely. And, you know, the journalists that cover the campaign have an obligation to put individual events into context. And so when you have an open feud between the Speaker of the House and the nominee of his same party, that is a situation that is unprecedented and does deserve mm-hmm. coverage. When you have a presidential nominee feuding with the family of a dead soldier, for example, or being accused by a dozen women of sexual misconduct, these are stories that we are almost obligated to cover as a press corps dedicated to accountability and holding those who would like to be in power to account.
And Laura, it seemed like there was no love lost between the media, such as it is, and Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's famously kind of prickly and standoffish when it comes to the media.
Yes, but let me just sort of add one other piece to this. There's no evidence that negative news coverage is any worse for a candidate than news coverage. In other words, it really matters that a candidate is getting sort of news coverage and media attention. It may not matter whether it's positive or negative. I think our celebrity culture attests to this on a daily basis. We see our celebrities, be it Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt or Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, in the news every single day with crazy scandals and sort of shocking, you know, revelations. And yet none of it in any way really dims their celebrity. And I think that is something that Donald Trump knew. And I think it's what he used. And I think it's why every day he looked to also incite essentially controversy with his words and actions.
Sam, you want to weigh in on this at all, the sort of negative coverage and how that played with the public?
Yeah, let me turn this to the topic of, in some sense, narrow casting and also the cognitive science of how we see other groups. Part of party loyalty comes from seeing another group as being totally unacceptable, and part of that comes from negative coverage. And so polarization really feeds on negative coverage. And here, I think there's a certain tendency in the news media to go after things that seem like the most negative thing. And as you just heard, there are some stories about Trump that are substantively important, that any person who committed those offenses or said those things would be subject to the same scrutiny. And so I think that it's objectively not really the case that somehow coverage was biased against Trump. I mean, look, if Hillary Clinton had said any of those things, which is sort of unimaginable, that the coverage would have been every bit the same. And mm-hmm. so I think there's some I think there is some question of why it is that there's a tendency to run off after a story like this email story, because the odd thing about the email story is that objectively it didn't really seem like it had legs, but at the same time there was a hunger for the story and there was a desire to hear the story. And I think in some ways media are responsive to what people want to see and what people want to hear, in the sense of not necessarily pandering to them, but like, look, everybody can do analytics and see which stories get read.
Right.
And so I think the email thing, you know, is in some ways a direct response to how in touch we are with audiences. And you know, I think in a Madisonian sense, is that a good thing? Like Madison thought that the republic should be the people somewhat separated from their legislators so the legislators could cool down the passions of the people. And it feels like because of technology and communication, we seem to be pretty far away from that right now.
Well, and Donald Trump with his tweets is a perfect example of that, Sam.
Yes, exactly. He can be in touch with him. There's a sense in which we were talking about him being a birther. He is, in a very deep sense, one of them raised up to become president. And so 30 or 40% of Republican voters from the start supported that supported Donald Trump. And they communicate with him. He communicates back to them. He is a very much a creature of this rapid communication that was unthinkable. Imagine trying to reach any faction of voters in the countryside back in the age of James Madison, and that just wasn't possible. And so technology has made it possible to rapidly communicate across great distances, and voters in Florida, Wyoming, Michigan, what have you, all these people can suddenly have the same message, think about the same thing, right, whether it be Hillary Clinton and her email server management, or Donald Trump's Access Hollywood tape. And here I am doing the same thing, equating the two.
Exactly. Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me read some more comments. Then I have a question for you, Byron, about fact-checking this election season. An email from Georgia: this election says to me we're far from post-racial in so many ways. An email from Jennifer: the electoral system is institutionally biased towards conservative states, which are also more sexist states. An email from Trudy: anyone but a woman. And a comment from Keith: how did Trump win? As my dad, a lifelong Democrat and United Auto Workers Union member, always said, when the Democratic Party abandons the American worker will abandon the Democratic Party. Let me put something to you, Byron, and I had brought this up over the last year or so, but when the fact checkers looked at Donald Trump's comments, the things that he said on the campaign trail, comparing that to Hillary Clinton, his pants on fire, his Pinocchios far outnumbered hers, something like 75 to about 25. And yet, obviously, that didn't seem to matter to a lot of voters. Are we post fact checking these days?
I think that's a great question. And not only are we post-fact-checking, but the circulation of completely false things on the internet is reaching epic proportions. And, I know it's a cliche for journalists to say on both sides, but it is happening on both sides. I do think it's worse on the conservative side, but there are progressive websites who spent the entire primary season insisting Bernie Sanders was winning, and we've seen the effects of conservative media, often not even media, just websites, posting completely incorrect things. So, you know, the media is having an incredibly difficult time keeping up with or trying to keep people honest, and Trump is a special case of this. I mean, we talked a little bit about the birther thing earlier. That was the first example. It was completely incorrect. Everyone who ever looked at it concluded it was completely incorrect, and yet there was nothing the media could say or do to dissuade about 20-25% of voters of this notion that the president was not born in America and not eligible for the presidency. And Donald Trump is a big part of that, and he built his campaign on similar themes. And right up until the final day, he was tweeting that he was largely, quote, largely self-funding his campaign, which was not true. In between was a string of statements of very dubious validity. And so we in the media simply have not figured out how to respond.
Laura, picking up on one of the comments that we got about union support, do you think the Democrats and Hillary Clinton herself and maybe even President Obama have abandoned the unions? And I ask that knowing in one of the primary debates that Donald Trump said he didn't even believe in the minimum wage. Again, I'm trying to sort of reconcile what was said on the campaign trail and what the voters said yesterday.
Well, I think one of the things that is so interesting is actually if we go back to the 2008 primary election between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, what you saw was those two candidates essentially splitting the Democratic Party coalition in half. She was carrying essentially white blue-collar workers. He was carrying this coalition of the ascendant, which included minorities, women, and people with college-educated sort of backgrounds and who were part of this creative class in the urban areas. And I do think that when he won the primary in 2008 and his coalition then became the sort of standard primary sort of coalition and faction in the Democratic Party, you did see the Democrats move away from her voters. And I think there were many people, especially in places that she won in those primaries between, her and Barack Obama, that in fact decided to either opt out in 2012 because they couldn't bring themselves to vote for Mitt Romney, but did look at coming back in and came back on the side of Trump in 2016.
It's interesting. It'd be interesting to find out because it looked certainly a number of the union leadership or unions themselves endorsed Hillary Clinton, and one wonders whether the union membership how they voted. Let me get Marianne from looks like Medford, New Jersey, to join us. Marianne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
For taking my phone call.
Sure, go ahead, Marianne.
I've been following the election. Last night I stayed up till 4 in the morning. I was stunned and shocked and just so frustrated. And my question is, and all the political analysts, no one brought this up, and I just wondered if this is a valid question. It looked to me like Hillary and Donald Trump were neck and neck in so many states. And then Donald Trump would win by a couple points. And then there you would see Gary Johnson have a couple points. And I just feel like if he hadn't been in the race, I feel that the Democrat, Hillary, would have had those points. And I feel that the whole thing could have been turned around.
Well, Mary,
and I just feel like that was kind of like a sabotage. And no one has talked about that. I don't know if this is a valid question.
No, it's fair enough.
I'm so frustrated.
Sure. Well, and I mean, people get to run for office and people get to vote for who they want to vote for. Nonetheless, to you, Sam, as you look at some of these third party candidates, and Gary Johnson, of course, was the top vote getter among the third party candidates. Was he significant this election?
Yes, definitely. If you look at 4 years ago, the perennial candidates, it seems, are Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. And Gary Johnson barely broke 1% in national voting 4 years ago. If you look in these close states like Michigan, where Trump appears to have won by 0.2 percentage point, Pennsylvania, where the win appears to be about 1 percentage point for Trump over Clinton. Yet in these states, something like 3 to 4% of voters voted for either Gary Johnson and, to a much smaller extent, Jill Stein. And so we're looking at a situation in which dissatisfaction with both candidates perhaps led voters to be willing to vote, willingness to vote for these minor party candidates. And certainly, whatever mistakes have been made by people who analyze polls, 3% or 4% is greater than 1%. Mm. Pretty sure about that one.
Yes.
And so one could well imagine that that there was something going on with Johnson voters that that was very important here this year.
And Sam, we're almost out of time here, but do we know, did he take what would have been Trump or Clinton and or Clinton supporters?
That's hard to say. Most of the information on that comes from polling well in advance. We're talking about margins so small here that I think it's really difficult to say. As of a few months ago, Johnson voters seem to be split between Clinton and Trump. Hard to know exactly what those proportions are. And so that's going to be a job for future analytics.
Well, on that note, Sam Wong, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
And I guess back to the drawing board for you, right?
Yes.
And he's co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Byron Tao, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he covers Washington for the Wall Street Journal. And Laura Brown, I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Joining us from the studios of George Washington University, where she is associate professor and interim director of the Graduate School of Political Management. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be talking much more about this election after this very short break. We'll be right back.